Good to have you with us again. There are extra sets of notes for all three nights, and if you're going to buy the CDs or the tapes, you can take those notes with you and use them again, and they'll be useful, hopefully. In the last couple of nights, we have spent some time learning big words, talking about conditions in our world that are a little bit frightening and depressing. I had more than one person say to me, "It's really a bummer. What's going on out there?" I had no idea how bad it was. And actually, that's kind of part of one of the reasons we're doing this. We get into the workaday world, making a living and raising our families and just getting along, and we forget how things drift. We used to body surf down in Southern California all the time, and you know that when you get out into the water, you got to watch the beach, because if you don't watch it, you wake up one moment and you look at the beach and it doesn't look familiar at all because you drifted way down. Our culture is drifting, and we're keeping track of it in the time we spend here so that we can know how to speak into it. I want you to open with me, if you would, please, to John chapter 17. This has always been God's plan. There's no reason to panic. There's no reason for us to think that the Lord does not know about postmodernism, okay? This is not catching him by surprise. He's left us here on purpose. He's given us truth, and he's teaching us how to represent him. John chapter 17 is what's known as the high priestly prayer of Jesus. It's the prayer he prayed on the night before he was crucified. And in it, there's a great deal of theology. And I'd like you to begin in verse 13, and we'll read down through verse 18. "But now I come to you," he says to his father, "and these things I speak in the world, that they," the disciples, "may have my joy made full in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they're not of the world, even as I am not of the world." Remember the talk he had with Pilate? He said, "My kingdom is not of this age." Verse 15, "I do not ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one." We would love to be taken out, and we're always looking for reasons to leave. Especially when you find out how bad the world is and how goofy it is, how mentally sick it really is, we're thinking, "I want out of here." And so a lot of times what we do is we try to circle the wagons, try to stop thinking, try to stop engaging the world, because it is tiring, and you get tired of swimming upstream. You get tired of being the only sane person in the office, the only person who believes that knowledge starts with God. And that means if you're the only person who believes that in your circle of friends, you're the only sane person in your circle of friends. And that is not a joke. You're the only person who thinks clearly because you think of God first. And you get tired of this. We get depressed by it. And we begin to think, well, the world is going to win. The world is going to overpower everything. But it's not. The Word of God is more powerful. The Lord knows what He's doing. And He never designed us to escape out of here until the last day. He's got us here on purpose. And so He says, "I'm not asking you to take him out. I'm asking you to leave him in, just protect him from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Set them apart," that's what sanctify means, "set them apart in the truth." Set them apart in the truth. Put their minds and their hearts and their souls in the truth. Your word is the truth. As you sent me into this world, I've sent them into this world. It's a good reminder for us. Because as we read about the condition of the world, and you start finding little things. That's another great thing in this little conference. I've had emails and personal notes from people. They'll come up and show me things they found or saw or heard. "Hey, this is exactly what we were talking about. This is exactly what we were talking about." Yeah. And it's wonderful to be able to see it. It's wonderful to be able to identify foolish thinking and call it what it is. try it. I had a friend who just gave me a picture of a Starbucks cup with the most outrageous nonsense written on the side. Starbucks is a great purveyor of nonsense. It is. It is. Philosophical nonsense. A lot of that in there. You can go in there, just take a little field trip down there, have a cup of coffee, and read some of the spiritism and some of the kind of silliness that you see. Let's go back through the material just a little bit. There'll be a little bit of a review. In premodernism, it says from antiquity, roughly to the 18th century, God supplies order. Cosmos mystifies us. There must be someone or something out there. If we pay attention, we can understand him or them or it. There is an awareness of what's going on. In this world, truth is what? Truth corresponds to reality. Knowledge was awareness of truth, and it was available and desirable, right? But in the pre-modern world, they really expected to have to really think about this a lot or to get revelation from God. One way or another, they were looking for the big answers. They believed they were out there. They believed there was some great unity. They couldn't quite figure out if it was physical or spiritual. And the Lord was speaking to the Hebrews. They had the answer. But the Greeks were wondering, is it spiritual? Is it physical? But they believed something big was out there. So they knew that they needed help to understand it. Even if the help was from a particularly brilliant teacher or whatever, but they needed to know and they wanted to know. The universe was open, an open universe. What's an open universe? Supernatural is interfacing with the natural, and their universe was a bit too open, which means they were attributing to the supernatural things that may not have been, and they were involved in some supernatural things in certain portions of the world, involved in some supernatural things we would say were blatantly demonic, blatantly spiritistic. In fact, so much so that the Lord outlawed that. He specifically outlawed it and would not allow his people to mess with it. They had a wide open universe. Okay, then we move into modernism, roughly the 18th to the 20th century. We can find order without God. Here's the motto. The cosmos interests us. There must be some big concepts out there that we can find without God's help. The truth is out there. Truth in this particular thing corresponded to reality. Still, they still believed in a correspondence view of truth. The goal was to understand something, and if you understood truth, you were understanding the way things really are, even in the invisible world. Whether you believed in the invisible world or not, you believed that you could understand essences, you could understand what was there, and your understanding was corresponding with reality, a correspondence view of truth. Knowledge was awareness of truth, and it was available and desirable, but with no help from theoretical thought or God, and especially God. No help from God. They didn't want very much theoretical thought either, a lot of them, but they would put up with theoretical thought, rationalistic thought, some of the stuff that was done in the Middle Ages, but they didn't want to hear from God during the modern period. Now that grew. Please be aware that it wasn't just like one day everybody wanted to hear from God and the next day nobody wanted to. That's not how it worked. And that's not how it works now. It was this shifting that happened. And modernism started with the idea that we do already believe in God, but let's pretend we don't need him to think. Well, then it went from that to we don't need him to think. And then it went from that to we don't need him at all. And by the end of the modern period, atheism was the main way of thinking. And of course, that turned out to be terribly depressing. The universe was closed. By the end of the modern period, they came to the conclusion there simply is no supernatural. And even if there is a supernatural, you cannot know it. Who's the guy who told you you can't?
Play on words.
My quizzes are pretty easy here. It's not quite as easy if you take a class. The Kantian divide. Clear back at the time our nation was being born, thinkers were developing ways of dealing with metaphysics. And having been taught that the human mind is the only arbiter of truth, and then having come to the conclusion by the use of the human mind that everything relies on our perceptions, And then under radical skepticism, wondering if any of our perceptions are really true, they basically decided, or Kant put all the thinking into one bucket, and he said, you cannot know anything that is not empirical. Bottom line is, there was no such thing, and this is very much the rule to this very day, there was no such thing as non-empirical knowledge. There was theory that was not empirical. But in order to be called knowledge, it had to be empirical. Remember the little circle with the top half, what was it called? Noumenal. Noumenal. And that included what? God, essences, spirit, self, things as they are, things in themselves, a direct quote from Immanuel Kant, things in themselves. The bottom half was called the what? The phenomenal. That's the stuff we can know, and that's all we can know, and that's where knowledge, all the knowledge we work with is in the lower realm, the phenomenal realm. The universe was closed. It was as if you cut off the top of that little circle and you live in the bottom half. If you are a person who says, I have any real knowledge, it is scientific and by definition does not reach across into the noumenal realm. The main characteristic is that ultimate truth could and should be found by human thought without God in it, but that the ultimate truth had to be empirical. If you're going to know it, it can only be empirical. And where's that going to leave you? Buying medication. It is. And by the end of the modern period, people were realizing that all this wonderful promise of modernism was in ashes, especially in Europe, because the idea of living without God had created such horrible, horrible cultures. It had created this violence, this horrible genocidal violence. And it stayed in Russia even after Stalin, because they maintained that state-sponsored atheism long after Stalin. And to this day, in that country, in the states there, to preach the gospel, people love to hear it, but you can see the result of generations and generations of atheism. It's brutal. It's quite brutal. And what we take for granted in morals, even in our culture, which is post-Christian, and we're finding out about it here, it still has a higher moral standard than you find in countries that have been steeped in atheism. The reason is because modernism, when it threw God out, ended up in complete moral chaos. They could not maintain a sense of moral integrity. And they realized this, and the thinkers in Europe, especially in France, began to say, we have got to find a better way. But they had burned the bridge to God because they had bought into the idea that you will not be able to cross over. So they had to find a new way. And this new way is what we have called, or what has been called, post-modernism. It's a way of thinking following modernism. And where it's going to go, nobody knows. But where it is right now is a rather sad place. Notice the motto, well, we didn't need order anyway. Chaos is good. Who cares about the cosmos? Modernism tried to straighten us out and almost killed all of us. We need to stop trying to figure out ultimate truth and just pull together in our global village. There are lots of big ideas out there. We should accept or honor them all, because the ultimate truth is that there is no ultimate truth. There is only survival. And we talked about the TV shows, as a matter of fact, in which survival is the ultimate thing. Here are the main characteristics, and we'll go kind of quickly through this, and then we'll get into the material where we left off last night. Skepticism triumphs. Ultimate truth and knowledge are not available and not desirable. That is a first. That is a first. Now, people do not want to know. In fact, they're afraid of the big ideas. They're afraid of the idea that if someone says they know truth, they know real truth, they're going to end up like Hitler or Stalin, and they're going to be oppressive. So skepticism has now triumphed. Skepticism has become a virtue. Doubt has become a virtue. Why? Because it's the only way to keep yourself from trying to force other people to believe things and ending up the way they saw everything going haywire. And so they consider it to be noble to be skeptical. But skepticism, as we're going to see, is a real problem. It's not new with postmodernism. It dates all the way back to Protagoras and even before Protagoras, BC, several hundred years, where people said that you cannot know for sure. But now notice how it's grown to the point where now it's a grassroots sense, a feeling among the intelligentsia at the grassroots level, where they're saying, we believe it is morally superior to say that you cannot know. That's never been the case until now. The unaided human intellect is still the only source of knowledge, but it doesn't get us anywhere important. And that's perfectly fine. Notice that truth is not available because the Kantian divide can still not be crossed. Like modernism, postmodernism begins not with God's knowledge, but with man's. But on the other hand, unlike early modernism, it comes to the conclusion that universal knowledge and certainty about truth are completely impossible, and nothing important can be known for sure. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't believe things are important. It just means they have to find a new way to define what's important, a new way to define capital T truth. Truth is not considered that which corresponds with reality. Why would that be in the postmodern world? Why? Why would they have to say truth is not necessarily what corresponds with reality? Because if it corresponds with reality, what's the case? You're right. And someone else is wrong, and you are an oppressor of their opinions. It is not considered, truth is not considered to be that which corresponds with reality. There's no outside reality. Truth now is simply coherence. A truth is simply my idea of how things ought to work in my little universe, or ours. Actually, it gets a little broader than my universe. We have our universe that we've decided as a subculture to put together. And then another group has their little universe with their subculture and their socially constructed truth. Remember I mentioned that quote from the sociology book? The problem is not that groups don't create certain social structures. Everybody knows that. The problem is when they say, ultimate truth doesn't exist. This is all there is. Everybody knows that social structures have been produced by human beings, and that some things that are polite in this culture are not polite in another culture, and vice versa. And there's a ton of that kind of stuff. And nobody argues about that. Nobody. The difference comes when a person says, because those things are different from culture to culture, therefore capital T truth must also be different from culture to culture. And if it's different from culture to culture, therefore there isn't one overarching sense of truth, which is a break in logic. Just because there are varying opinions does not mean that they're all right. But we'll talk about that. But that's how the thinking goes. They don't like foundationalism, which is a technical term. Oh, further up on there, radical postmoderns don't trust language because they believe it simply is an extension of our own perceptions, a sort of game. In fact, they call it language games. A creation. You create reality with your language, with your words. And we as a group create our reality and sort of create all of what we consider to be truth. Which is why they're real big on the way you say things. You have to say things. In this kind of a culture, you have to say things in a right way. There is a politically correct way to say things. Now, why is that? Because they believe you are really creating culture by the way you say things. And there is an element of truth to that. But are you creating truth, capital T? Are you creating reality when you say things? That's where they're taking it. They don't trust language. They don't like foundationalism because that's the idea that if you have one thought, you can build on it. Once you know something that's certain, you can actually build on that certainty. They don't like that idea, mainly because it leads to a kind of certainty, and they don't want to have certainty. They've already decided not to. The truth is probably not out there. They don't like the X-Files. And even if the truth is out there, our minds are never going to get it. So we're not saying there's no truth out there. Well, some of them are, some of them aren't. Some are saying there's absolutely no truth and I'm sure of it. Think about that. Others, a little more honest, would say, well, We don't think there's truth. We doubt it. The truth is out there. I doubt it. But it doesn't matter because we can't know it anyway. Now, that is classic skepticism. You know, you might think a skeptic was a person that says, I know there's no truth. That's actually not true. That skeptic is very certain about something. I know there's no truth. A real skeptic says, well, you can't know. And I'm committed to that. You simply can't know. And we'll get back to that. That's a break in logic too. But that is classic skepticism. It's just you don't know, you don't know, you don't know. I doubt it, I doubt it, I doubt it, I doubt it, I doubt it. And you can doubt literally anything and it drives you crazy. But that's where it is. They followed Kant's break between phenomenal and noumenal, but they did not follow Kant's moral argument for the existence of God. And I will give you a little bit of Kant's moral argument. Though he is the guy who said you can't, he turned right around and said, but you should pretend. And his logic in it for the replacement for God, which he called the moral imperative, his logic was, you've got to act as if God is there. And his logic is very, very good, and we'll see it later. Truth, then, is arrived at by consensus of the community. People essentially vote, but they don't really vote. What they do is sociologists find out that this is what's going on, and then we stamp that with approval and make laws to reflect it. Incidentally, this is why the pulpit is one of the most important things in this country. It is one of the few places in this country where you can talk like this still and not lose your career. That's not true in Canada anymore. You can lose your career in Canada if you talk about homosexuality from the pulpit. But in this country, pulpits can still do this. Do not underestimate the power of the Christian pulpit because it reaches grassroots people every single day. And the truth can actually be told, and it is being told. The gospel is being preached, despite the fact that sometimes you wonder if you've been in some places. But the fact is, there are many, many powerful pulpits. And people overlook that, that it is a way to reach grassroots people who come in to hear something substantive once a week or twice a week. They should hear something substantive, and they should be thinking. And that is a good thing for us to do, and that's a good thing for us to pray for. I also said or made note of the fact that truth was not desirable because when people think they're right about ultimate truth, they become oppressive. We made that point a little earlier, so I won't belabor it. B, the universe is closed with regard to facts, but strangely open with regard to values and spirituality. Interesting world we live in. On the one hand, we've got the idea that facts are all here in the scientific realm. And then on the other hand, on the top half of the balloon, it's wide open. And people believe in all kinds of amazingly ridiculous things in order to get spirituality. There's a real subjective feel to it, but you've got to understand that that willingness to put up with anything in that realm is all under one condition. You do not ever call it fact. You do not ever say, I know for sure that this is the case. As long as your spirituality stays completely private, does not affect your public life at all, and is never taken to be a fact, and you never insist on it being taught as a fact, you're fine. In a postmodern world, they'll put up with you forever. In fact, they rejoice in the diversity of having you there. But you had better not tell people that there really is a right and wrong. Because that's certainty. That means you're talking about facts. And that means you've come back down into the realm of real public knowledge. And that you can't do that with religion in this culture. Remember that virtue is found in three social concepts. Diversity. Why? Because diversity has to be there for us to collect all the data so that we can create this truth that we're trying to create. So diversity becomes an automatic good. And it kind of doesn't matter who you are, what you say, or at least it doesn't matter on the surface. It's interesting because in diversity training, when you get involved in being trained in diversity, which you need to be in order to really be effective in it, one of the things you find out real, real quick is that in the diversity, they do not want to hear from Christianity. Period. End of conversation. They want it to be diverse. But because Christianity insists on certain facts, notably the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, as an actual fact, immediately when that comes up, there is this tension. But diversity, nevertheless, is a virtue that is a social concept that is very much a part of the postmodern reality. Secondly, personal choice, moral freedom to choose. Of course, obviously, because you're following your own star, everybody follows their own star, nobody tells anybody else they're doing anything wrong, particularly. And so personal choice is important. Pluralism then becomes a virtue. Empirical pluralism, which is just reality. We live in a multicultural world, and we should be polite and diplomatic to each other and respect one another as human beings. And the Lord Jesus told us exactly that. He said, love your neighbors. And he was talking about the Romans, and he was talking about the Samaritans, and he was talking about all the people. They were multicultural. And he said, you should love them. But that's not what pluralism really talks about. Pluralism is philosophical and religious, and it's the idea that there are many religious and philosophical ideas and systems, and this is as it should be because they are all to be treated as true. Now that is a big problem, because they can't all be true unless you alter them pretty radically in order to make them look or appear to be true. And so philosophical pluralism is where we find ourselves. And there are two ideas upon which it's built. When you talk to a true pluralist, this true pluralist will have one of two ideas, and you should ask him, you should be able to say, I wonder what kind of a pluralist this person is. It's one kind says, essentially, religious and philosophical differences don't matter because they're not about facts. We can differ all over the place. It doesn't matter. We're not talking about factual reality here. We're not talking about anything that we should argue about. We're only talking about how I feel when I'm done meditating. How can that possibly hurt you? Because, see, the purpose of religion is subjective. The purpose of religion is for me. How does that hurt you? And we're not talking about facts anyway, so why should we be upset? That's a certain type of pluralist. There are many people who are that way, and they're just like, hey, I've got no problem with lots of different religions. Pick the one, or better yet, take a little bit from each one. A little smorgasbord thing, and create your own. Boutique religion. Just go around and take all the little favorite parts of the different ones. People do that all the time. Very common. Now, there's another kind, and that's the kind that would say another type of person in pluralism, very different than the one I just mentioned. This person says, no, they do matter. The philosophical and religious differences do matter, but they all point to one great religious truth, which each of them apprehends only in part. This is Protestant liberal religious pluralism, notably under the leadership of John Hick, but also Diana Eck, that I quoted last night, and various others. Now, let me ask you something. From what you know about modernism, and you guys are becoming now pretty conversant with the material, from what you know about modernism and postmodernism, this kind of pluralism that I just mentioned, is it modern or is it postmodern? It fits nicely in postmodernism, but it's modern. Why? Why? Why is it modern? They're still looking for a big truth. Anybody looking for an overarching truth, what the postmoderns call a meta-narrative, that means big story. But you got to make better words than big story, so they made it meta-narrative. Anybody looking for a big story is a modern. But see how this kind of fits together very nicely. John Hick and company and the Protestant religious liberals who are ready to throw out the resurrection and throw out the virgin birth and throw out grace and anything about hell, all of that stuff goes in order to make Christianity fit into their idea of this blender kind of religion thing. But their purpose is to find the big overarching. See, they're saying this all points to one great reality. That's very important. And that is modern. These guys are modern thinkers. The Jesus Seminar people. These are modernists, and they live in a closed universe too, most of them. They are modernists doing religion in the old modern way and still trying to find a big answer. A postmodern is more like the first kind of pluralism that I mentioned. It doesn't matter. There's lots of different religions in lots of different ways, and the more the merrier, because why? They're not factual. Doesn't matter. Whatever works for you. Three common emphases. You can see how they come together. Between modernism and postmodernism, we looked at Romans 1 last night. Was anybody struck with just how well Romans 1 fits with the condition of human thought in 21st century Western world? It was written 2,000 years ago. And it's just like click, click, click. Once you know what to look for, this autonomy, the drive for autonomy, I will be a law unto myself. See, this is the human drive. That's because the human soul in rebellion against God is not trying to cooperate with God, they're trying to compete with Him. And that's the drive for autonomy, because only God is autonomous. Autonomos, self-law, only God is autonomous. Only God is self-sufficient. We are contingent beings. That means we can only live because someone else lives. You can only live because someone else lives. You rely on someone else for life. You did not bring yourself into existence. And you cannot stop yourself from dying. You are a contingent being. But we have this little fantasy of autonomy, which is senseless and ridiculous. But we love the idea. And it's exactly what Romans says is the heart of all idolatry is simply the decision to say, I will be autonomous from my Creator. And then opposition to the real knowledge of God, same thing. He says they hold down what they already know to be true. And this is what makes the Lord so angry on a personal level. They know He's there, they know it internally, and they look around, and they know the law of cause and effect is true. And the Lord even says it's true, because He says, you should know that I'm there by looking at the universe. That is implicit endorsement of the law of cause and effect. Let that soak in a minute. What does that tell you about the epistemology that the Lord expects us to use? I know it's a stretch. It tells us it has something to do with foundationalism. It tells us that logic is there because the Lord actually uses logic. He actually uses it. That means epistemological systems that deny the basic laws of logic will automatically become idolatrous and probably have idolatrous roots. Now, we're not talking, for those of you who might read on the subject, we're not talking about full-blown Cartesian certainty foundationalism. But we are talking about God saying, I use logic, the law of cause and effect, the law of the excluded middle, the law of non-contradiction. These are actual things that human beings have to believe in order to communicate with each other and falsify statements. And we'll get into this more, but I wanted to raise the issue at this point. I wanted us to understand that the knowledge about God is actually implying these things. Let's move down to the radical subjectivism. Same idea in Romans, the same connection, autonomy, the idea that the human mind would say, I don't want God, and then the idea that God says, you have to think in a certain way for you to resist my knowledge, and the laws that you see all around you is going to drive you insane. And that's exactly what happens. Radical subjectivity, a complete self-centeredness, is the only other way to live. If you do not live for God, you have to live for this age and for yourself. Ultimately, that is the way it will turn out. And he says, so you will end up worshiping the creature rather than the Creator. Just fits like a glove. Radical subjectivity. It all starts with me, the subject, and becomes completely circular. Which means in this world, in the world in which we live, nothing really means anything until it means something to me. Radical subjectivity. Now, everybody always kind of felt that way, even in the modern period. But when you see it actually fleshed out as a philosophical position, nothing really means anything until it means something to me. That's radical subjectivity. And that's really the common denominator in both modernism and postmodernism. It just gets really blown bigger than life in postmodernism. It's a full-blown philosophical idea. It's a virtue. It's a virtue to say, nothing really means anything till it means something to me. Why would I say that? Because once you say there is no objective reality, what you're really saying is, unless I perceive it in the lower half of Kant's little deal, unless it's my perception, there's no meaning to it. And that is a very weird way to live. And yet people live that way all the time. So let's talk about the problems with truth decay, okay? Now, truth decay is such a tricky little saying, and I wanted to take credit for it, but I can't. It was Douglas Gruteis is a philosopher at Denver Seminary and a theologian and an excellent writer on this subject, and if you get any of his books or articles, you will enjoy them. But he calls it truth decay in one of his books, and it's a great way to remember it. There are several things that are wrong, of course, with this, and I want to start asking some questions of it. Radical skepticism, first of all, is circular. It cannibalizes itself. Radical skepticism is circular. It cannibalizes itself. It is skeptical of everything except skepticism. Now, I want you to grasp that, because that is an Achilles heel. Because people really ought to have doubts about some of their doubts. That's what Robert Louis Stevenson said after he had been in a state of youthful atheism, he said. It's interesting, the happiest atheists are young. The older you get, the less atheism pays off, you know? Which I think is one of the reasons why the Lord said to Adam and Eve, you're going to start dying. Because if you don't face your mortality, you will never come to grips with who I am, now that you've turned away from me. But be that as it may, skepticism is self-defeating. It is circular. You can doubt literally everything, and the person that says, I am a radical skeptic, needs to be asked, have you doubted your doubts? Is it possible that you are wrong to doubt as much as you do? That is a very good question to ask a person who simply demonstrates himself to be a radical skeptic. It destroys meaning. Ultimately, it's an acid that destroys everything. So if you're talking to a person, they won't say, usually, a person that you discuss things with in a postmodern or even a modern context will not say, I'm a radical skeptic. But when you realize that no matter what you say, they doubt it, well, you know, that's not absolutely certain. That's not absolutely, absolutely certain. I mean, absolutely certain. I mean, it's not, I'm not absolutely sure, so therefore it can't be true, which is, of course, not true. You're talking to a skeptic, and you really should just offer this little piece of advice. You know what? You're living a rather hypocritical life because you do a lot of things you're not sure about. But you pretend that you won't do anything because you're not certain. You ought to have some doubts about your doubts. Skepticism is self-defeating. Skepticism is also counterintuitive to humans. It doesn't come naturally. That's what that means. We are created to trust people, our senses, and the world around us. And that's why depression results when we are not able to do that. Skepticism must be taught to us, and we must desire it for some reason. Now, why would a person want skepticism? According to Romans chapter 1, verses 18 and following. Because it's an excuse for autonomy. If you can say, I'm not sure God is out there, then you can say there's this tiny little bit of doubt. Then you can say, well, that's enough room for me to get over here and do what I want. And that's exactly what the scripture says, what happens in the human soul. Even though there's huge evidence for the existence of God, people say, well, I'm not absolutely sure. There's evil in the world. Even though the scriptures talks a lot about evil. No, there's evil in the world. I can't believe in God. You got to wonder if there might not be another reason why they don't want to believe in God. It is counterintuitive to be skeptical. You have to want to, and you have to be taught. Because children are automatically teachable, and they believe everything they're told. Little ones believe everything they're told. And they do not need to be, you know, they will simply ask Dad or Papa. I'm getting a lot of this now as Papa. They will ask, I will say, and I'm ready to back it up philosophically. And they don't care. They just say, okay. Where did I come from? The Lord created you.
And the cosmological argument and the teleological argument really back this up. You know anything about biology?
No, they don't care because they trust me. Which is, by the way, why it is such a cosmic crime to not tell children about God or to tell them he's not there. Imagine what people will have to answer for in eternity. Skepticism is counterintuitive. It needs to be preached all the time. People naturally fall back in. If you don't keep teaching them skepticism, they naturally fall back into trusting something outside themselves. They will try to trust something outside themselves. Sometimes silly things, they'll say, I don't believe in organized religion. And yet they will pay $250 an hour to hear a channeler channel a voice from a 35,000-year-old Phoenician warrior. And this is a person who's too smart to go to church. Maybe if we charge $250 an hour, and I got kind of a frog in my throat, we might be able to make some money. People fall for some really silly things because naturally we know we need to trust something. We know we want to. We were created to actually trust. And that's why when trust, by the way, is violated, because skepticism is actually counterintuitive, when trust is violated, we are terribly offended, and rightly so. Why do we have laws to ensure trust? Because we were created to live in a world where truth is told and trust is kept. And all of our laws protect that. Why? Why do we have this? Well, that's getting into the moral argument for the existence of God. But it's an amazing thing once you start to think about it. Skepticism really eats itself alive. When you doubt everything, it is completely self-destructive, and it's counterintuitive to human beings. So let me say something to you if you are a skeptic listening to these lectures, either on CD or here in person. Let me just say something. You cannot go on forever doubting everything, and you know it, or you would not be listening to what I'm saying. I want to get into that level. I want you to know why you're here or why you're listening to this. It's because even though you might call yourself a skeptic, there's something deep inside of you that says, if there is a bigger truth, I want to know it. Grab that and realize that is because you were created by the truth-telling creator. And your desire for that truth is put there by him. That's why radical skepticism is counterintuitive and it is so self-destructive. People need to have doubts about their doubts. Secondly, philosophical pluralism is not reality. It is not reality. Don't let anybody tell you that it is. Following Nietzsche's perspectivism, which is his idea that everybody has their own perspective, that's from Nietzsche, except he took it, he wasn't just talking about which restaurant you want to go to. He was talking about ultimate truth, and he was really saying all that matters is perspectives. Nietzsche's a transitional figure between modernism and postmodernism. I mean, either of them could claim Nietzsche. And so people following him in this perspectivism thing assume that ultimate truth is unattainable, and that's the ultimate truth. I assume that you guys already figured that out, that this is completely circular thinking, and it will implode ultimately. Perspectivism, let me quote somebody here, perspectivism reduces to a kind of collective autism. Everyone has a perspective, no one has the truth, and that's really the truth. Once a person says, well, the real truth is there is no truth, all you have to do is ask him, is that the final truth now? And so, but what happens is that because it's not a reality, you end up having to brainwash people. This pluralism, note on your notes, forced tolerance necessitates the rewriting of history and culture for the shaping of our thoughts toward pluralism. The whole purpose now, since there's no ultimate truth, is to simply shape society as fast and effectively as we can. You get people into classes and you start teaching them there is no truth, and then you teach them that the ultimate reality is actually tolerance and openness, and then you can teach them anything from then on. they want us to change everything and rewrite the curriculum. So you have feminist studies, you have gay studies, you have porn studies. That was a new one on me. That's in Nancy Piercy's book, Total Truth. And she traced it down, and sure enough, several universities actually have porn studies, and you don't even want to know anymore about them. Deconstruction, which is the idea that you take a text and you assume that the original author didn't mean anything by it, and truly, and you take it apart and insert your own meaning, and that is new meaning. That's the real meaning of the text. It's an interesting thing because the deconstructionists all don't want you to do that with their books, but you do it everybody else's. These perspectives all seek to interpret reality from different vantage points, but without regard to whether any of these studies actually corresponds to truth. It doesn't matter. This person's view, let's get a master's degree in this kind of truth. See? Yes, this is the way different people see life, but are they seeing it as it truly is? It doesn't matter. There is no truth. There are only truths, plural. What this does is it homogenizes all the religions, throws them into a blender, and mixes them up as a brand new religion. And by the way, whenever you hear people talk about this pluralism, you will hear the illustration of the elephant and the blind beggars. How many have heard the illustration of the elephant and the blind beggars? Oh, you're going to hear it. It's the favorite thing. It's the great parable of pluralism. In fact, I just saw one of my students at the college brought me a book, a new book that they got at Barnes & Noble, and it is all about this. And the guy who writes it thinks he has done such a tremendously profound and new thing by writing this book about that's this really old parable. And it's, you remember the story. There's a king who's kind of bored, and he has some courtiers, and he has an elephant. And so he brings in the blind beggars off the street, a bunch of them, and he brings the elephant there, and he says, okay, tell me what this is. And so every blind beggar feels a different part of the elephant. And you got the trunk, and you got the tusks, and you got the legs, and you got the tail. And each one says, it's like this, and it's like this. And it's like, it's so funny because the guy who writes this little book, he tells this whole story as if this is really profound. And the moral of the story is we all only have a part of the great elephant truth, whatever that may be. And you know, it makes perfect sense until you realize that the real moral of the story is that the king knows it's an elephant. If there were no sighted people there, the parable would make no sense at all. No one would know there was an elephant. You understand? That means that whoever's telling you the story is telling you, you're the blind beggar, pal. They're the king. Do you understand? So the guy who writes this book and says, oh, this is so heavy, you really need to understand this. He's saying, I see it all. I'm in touch with the elephant. I know that you're all just seeing a part of it. Oh, how do you know this? Well, I just do.
I doubt it.
Use a little skepticism. See, all that is a new philosophy, a new religion, just taking control of everything else with a little parable. Don't ever fall for it. And don't fall for blender philosophy either. In order to make all the religions look alike, you have to take the guts out of every single one of them. Anybody who knows any of the major world religions knows that they cannot be blended that way. That's why John Hick takes the resurrection out of Christianity and the exclusiveness and all the teaching about hell. He just literally guts Christianity in order to make it fit with everything else. Pluralism is not reality. Number three, Kant's two-story reality is crazy-making. Crazy-making. Crazy-making is a good word you should have. I don't know how technical it is, but you know when it's happening to you. It means that if I believe this, I feel crazy. Well, that's crazy making. And the two-story reality is crazy making because it defines God out of the discussion, leaves meaning out of the realm of reality. It means you really are supposed to live as though there's reality, but you have to admit there isn't any, and that is craziness. Listen to what this guy says. This is in an article called Why Intelligent Design Isn't. And of course, it's about President Bush's statement that intelligent design ought to be taught. And this guy just blows a gasket in this. He's a syndicated columnist, and he's very angry about this. Bush had said, "I think that part of education is to expose people to different schools of thought." That sounds like something from the ACLU. That sounds like something from a liberal university. How could you disagree with that at the academic level? Well, these guys disagree because what he was saying it about was intelligent design, which means maybe we're not just grown-up germs. But the idea that we're grown-up germs is so much a part of the religion of the system that they're just flipping out. They're, oh, no. Listen to what he says. "No, Mr. President, what education is all about is teaching students the facts and teaching them the truth. It is not about confusing fact with fiction, nor is it about mixing science with religion." Just line those up in the appropriate columns. Fact, fiction, science, religion. And make no mistake about it, the bogus doctrine called intelligent design has nothing to do with science. It is nothing but poorly disguised religion. Really? He says, first of all, it's ridiculous theory. Now listen to his logic. "There are a lot of things we don't understand. I don't know how my TiVo works, but that doesn't mean God made it. But somebody did. No, my TiVo was a tiny little spark of electricity billions of years ago. And now it's a PDA. Now it's a color television." No, he proved our point in his deal. Repeat after me. Crazy making. That's what that is. You can see a perfectly smart guy who doesn't realize. I mean, once you understand where he's coming from, of course, he's coming from the Kantian thing. He's underneath, and he's saying you can't know anything. And if you even talk about an intelligent designer, I know who you're talking about. And I don't want to know. Hey, don't you bother me with that. And I'll use any kind of logic I can to prove that you're wrong. Listen to what he says in the last paragraph of his article. "Before you start spouting off, Mr. President, about educational philosophy, we should go back to learning the ABCs. Religion is not science. Public school is not Sunday school. America is not Iran." Now, before you start throwing things and look at the serious lapse in logic. A guy who in every other worldview, he would say, hey, everybody's got a right to their opinion until someone talks about God. Does that tell you anything about this guy's headspace? And then to compare America with Iran just because there's a debate about intelligent design in this country, that is insane. That would require an entire article just to show the idiocy of that statement. But then to say, religion is not science. You see what's going on? You see, this break between fact and value, fact on the bottom, value on the top, is crazy-making. It makes people think in crazy ways. Why do they have to think in crazy ways? Because they still want to find meaning, but they have to find it with stuff that they have already said are not factual. And that makes them say nutty things. Listen to this. This is a statement about it. "The postmodern dilemma may be summed up by saying that ethics depends on the reality of something that materialistic science has declared to be unreal." And that does make you crazy. You can't live that way. You just can't do it. One postmodern professor, you know, people say, let me give you some examples before I give you that quote. People claim that language doesn't convey meaning, but they use language to do it. People claim that they are just molecules, then they live as though justice and love and honor and commitment really matter. People claim that organized religion can't be right and drift into mysticism because they're craving something. This is crazy making. This is a true story. It happened to a fellow that is a professor up north. He had a postmodern professor who did a brilliant dissertation on why you can't know anything. And then somebody raised the a question in the back, and they said, do you raise your 11-year-old son to believe that there is no sense to things, that morality is arbitrary, and that we really don't know anything about reality? After an extended and thoughtful pause, the professor replied, no, I don't. When he's older, I will talk to him about these things. I do believe them as a philosopher, but I cannot live this way, and especially not as a father. Well, good for him to be honest. But can you see that if you stay in this mental state where I know that the things I believe do not work in reality in my life, do you see what that does to your head? The Christian worldview is all that makes sense. The rejection of meta-narrative leaves us with no narrative at all. Meta-narrative, write that in there under D. The rejection of meta-narrative leaves us with no narrative at all. Meta-narrative is the big story. In postmodernism, there isn't one. Postmodernism refers to that number one under D. Postmodernism refers to the ultimate truth as the ultimate story, the meta-narrative. There is no big story. And it insists that there isn't one. There are just many smaller narratives, smaller personal cultural stories. So what they're saying about the human story is this. In other words, when they say there's no big story, people don't realize it until they start living it out. That means there's no story that makes any sense or makes any difference. Human life, then, is not a big story. It's a collection of short stories with no connection between them. And that is a hopeless way to live, because life is meaningless without justice. Now, note these things, and I don't have time to go into them too much. This is actually from the mind of Immanuel Kant, and I've adjusted what he says, but this is the basic logic. Remember that if you take meta-narrative out, if you have no large narrative, no big story, no ultimate ending, no real final judgment of anything, that means none of the smaller stories make sense. Please grasp that. This is not a point of freedom. This ends up putting us into bondage. Number one, postmodernism refers to the ultimate truth as the ultimate story, the meta-narrative. That's a word that is a buzzword in postmodern talk, meta-narrative. They use it all the time. It means big story, and their big deal is there isn't one. Now, in order for life to have meaning, there has to be justice. But in order for there to be justice, there has to be a judge, and that means it has to be a person. Wait a minute. For life to have meaning, there has to be some sort of justice. For justice to happen, there has to be a judge. And it has to be a person, because who cares what a computer thinks of you? Truly, all justice only has meaning because a person says it. Or a group of people. There is no justice without another being. That's crucial to understand. It has to be a person. And it has to be a person who cannot be swayed or lied to. That's not B yet. 2A, there must be a judge. 2B is still blank. 2B. Oh, no. Look, I'm going to get through this, okay? There has to be a judge, it has to be a person, and it has to be a person who can't be swayed or lied to. And there's only one way that can be. The person has to know everything and be completely good at the eternal level in order to be a judge that could judge this way to make meaning out of life. Well, this is sounding suspiciously like someone we know. B, there must be life after death, because we know that justice doesn't happen on earth in this way. C, and there must be some form of punishment. Think that through. The logic really does hold. For life to have meaning, there must be justice. For there to be justice, there has to be a real person who judges. And it can't just be any person. It has to be someone who can't be lied to and who knows all the details. That means that person has to be omniscient, and that person has to be totally good. Notice, too, that this has to happen after this life, because we know for a fact, everybody knows for a fact, here on earth, justice doesn't happen. Even people who are postmodernists know that if there is such a thing as justice, it does not always happen on earth. So if there will ever be justice, it has to happen after this life, which means you're stuck with the idea of an afterlife. And then finally, there has to be some form of punishment. If there is no form of punishment, then there is no accountability, and the judgment is completely meaningless. Uh-oh. You see, once you go down this, there's no big story trail,
And it's at first it sounds great. Oh, who cares? Well, then you say, well, who cares? And then it's who cares? And then it's who cares? And then you're trying to make meaning out of nothing because there's no accountability. And if there's no accountability, you do not count. And people can't live that way. You say there's no meta-narrative. What you really mean is we haven't found it the old-fashioned way. There really is a meta-narrative. Quote, this is the tragedy of the postmodern age. The things that matter most in life, freedom and dignity and meaning and significance, have been reduced to nothing but useful fictions, wishful thinking, irrational mysticism. So what does postmodernism do? And so did modernism, by the way. In order to acquire some sort of meaning without a meta-narrative, they borrow concepts from, guess where? Christianity and the Bible. The highest morality, the strongest metaphysic is in the scriptures, the Judeo-Christian scriptures, and even Islam's form of morality, which is a lot closer to the way you think than your own culture, by the way, in terms of its concept of morality, all comes from the Bible. And it's true that Muhammad elaborated on it, but he started thinking he was an Old Testament prophet. That's what he really thought of himself as. So in order to get any kind of meaning, postmodernism has to borrow and sort of cheat in order to get morals and ethics to say that we believe in these morals and ethics, because it has no real foundation for it. There's no meta-narrative. There's no ultimate judgment. There's no nothing, and it doesn't matter, period. But we're going to pretend there's something. What shall we pretend? Well, let's pretend honesty matters. Okay, where did we get that idea? Well, let's pretend we shouldn't cheat on our spouses, though we are going to probably, but let's pretend we shouldn't. Where did we get that idea? Let's pretend we shouldn't lie. Where did we get that idea? See, all the second half of the Ten Commandments, we'll take the second half, and we will simply say, we thought of these. It's the only way to make it work. And it's crazy making. So those are some problems